that be a bit of summary to you following her class of this morning? There has been some progress in relation to three of the homicides, three that were screened. So Dr. Reid will update you on those. And that does mean that a little paragraph of the business summary and not updated, so she'll be through that as she goes on.
First, I realise it was cold, I was in the main lane, I'm really sorry about that, but I'm stuck at the colour on the bridge. Also, before I begin, I need to make a correction to my evidence, which also applies previously to the evidence that I presented to the Commission, and this is with regard to paragraph 1.4, where I state that I understand that the Land Act boundaries that were notified in the proposed district plan were all produced by my study. I've come to the discovery quite recently that some of the boundaries that were notified were not actually ones that I had drawn or and so we're not subject to the process that I've described previously. So,
is this going to be a relevant point in future hearings? Have you able to distinguish between those that you did and those that you didn't?
Yes, I am, and it's not directly relevant to this hearing.
Right. Okay. But in terms of this hearing, that is the lines are the lines that you recommended to the council.
Okay. Right. I think
you're
going to speak with the district council to provide landscape evidence from Chapter 41 proposed to plan. In assessing the proposed changes to the zone and submission, my focus has been on ensuring that the appropriate management of the landscape of the zone continues. To do this, I consider a strong policy framework as important. References to having a quote, appropriate regard for landscape and visual amenity values, unquote, have been removed from the primary objectives of the zone, and a number of policies have similarly been altered or deleted. I consider it important that these be reinstated, these references be reinstated. Now, as you've been told, I've been out at that point this morning, having a very last night site visit, and that relates to what I discussed, particularly in paragraphs 4 and 5 of my summary of evidence. So I just need to read what I've said and see if that has altered. Actually, I don't think that paragraph 4 has altered particularly. Ms. Slugan, Mr. Takara and myself agree that the lot, that the area of G could absorb dwellings that are at home site type, could absorb dwellings under a home site type regime at a rate of approximately 2 per hectare, so approximately 8 home sites. Activity area F was more under dispute. Now what I've done today is I've walked the boundary, or part of the boundary of that activity area, and part of the ONL line that bisects that proposed area. And my conclusion is that the ONL line does bisect the F area, but the part of the area that is within the ONL has potential to absorb development. I think Ms. Boog is going to, she will talk about that in the evidence, but that was the conclusion of my site visit this morning. Plus, the lower area, FA, which is which is also bisected by the O&L line, but is definitely not part of what I would consider to be the outstanding natural landscape. I think that's a cartographical peculiarity. We also agreed that we consider that the density of development in that area should be transitional. I think they were proposing that it should be the same as the adjacent area D within Henry Downs, which is 17 to 26 lots per hectare. But I think in our agreed that a much lower density would be appropriate there, the transition between the dense development on the flats and the much more sensitively the development within the more sensitive landscape area. In terms of, I've said in paragraph 5 that I consider controls are necessary to protect the rock outcrops and indigenous vegetation, and I think that there's agreement on that issue as well. The concern, I guess, is how that is done, and I'm recommended that the tableland landscape overlay to be extended to incorporate those areas. What we have discussed today is the idea that all of what was in the BXP1, G and F, that there should be an overarching revegetation plan drawn up for that entire area, which would then illustrate areas where homeowners would be expected to do revegetation required of the adjunct to development on their home site, and to provide pallets of appropriate vegetation to be planted in those areas, with a view to enhancing natural character and to providing some mitigation to some of the development in the areas. So, paragraph 6, I'll go back to reading it now. The proposed farm preserve activity area, hang on, maybe I'll not actually read all this again. Oh yes, I do. This is the third area where we had some discussions this morning. I will read this. The proposed farm preserve activity area encompasses the area between the golf course and the northern zone boundary and is immediately upslope of RHDF and RHDG. At notification, 34 lots would be allowed within FP1. Jack's point is now made an alternative proposal consisting of 22 further home sites in this area, and these are identified in this part's evidence. I'm satisfied that all but home sites 51, 52 and 53 can be appropriately absorbed into the landscape. These three should be eliminated as they lack topographical containment. Now, we also looked this morning at three alternatives to those three home sites, three additional ones, which I thought were all acceptable. So I think they're going to modify their proposal to incorporate those. So they've agreed to move them from locations that I have thought problematic. And I say here, I also consider that an overarching revegetation plan for the area encompassing FP1, F and G should be prepared by the developer. Trent, submitted 195, requested that the ODP be reinstated for the tablelands area, which would eliminate FP1. I consider the proposed home site development in the context of regenerating indigenous vegetation to be an alternative. The O&L portion of the notified SP2 allows for up to 8 dwellings or visitor accommodation facilities. I consider that the priority on Peninsula Hill should be the protection of the landscape quality, allowing for indigenous revegetation, recreation and farming. An alternative proposal to establish two super home sites has been made by that point and needs to discuss the evidence of some slugger in the past. I remain opposed to the establishment of these areas because of issues of visibility, particularly the effects of lighting at night, and the difficulties of establishing access, which I do not consider to be achieved without adverse effects on the landscape. I consider the proposed education precinct adjacent to Jack's Point Village to be acceptable. Jack's Point now is to incorporate this area into the village activity area, and I consider this less acceptable because it would allow for high density development and taller buildings in an area which is visible from the state highway. I disagree with Ms. Kluger regarding the extent of this effect, but consider it only slightly more significant than she. Jack's Point Hill is an important landscape feature. I'm concerned that the open space landscape activity area would allow for the construction of fencing, farm buildings, tracks and the undertaking of mining. I consider the activities outside the lodge activity areas should be restricted to trail formation, recreational activities and indigenous revegetation, as is currently the case. Wildgrass from the 567 wishes to have three new areas established as lodge activity areas. One of these to be used for vehicle parking is appropriate. The other two are not appropriate by identification in the structure plan. I understand from Ms. Freeman's evidence that this is acceptable to Wildgrass. I also consider that earthworks should have additional controls imposed in this area. In all of the activity areas, the activity stages of development have been relaxed, so that residential development in particular would generally be permitted, subject only to control by the Jack's Point Design Review Board. I am opposed to this in areas of the zone that are part of the sensitive landscape. Including the controls methods to achieve objectives, which is the header section of the design guidelines, appropriately modified as performance standards would satisfy my concerns with those principles. Landscape protection areas are included as overlays on the structure plan, retaining the role of vegetation management, but now also having implications for possible development. The tableland overlay is missing from the notified structure plan, but has been reinstated into the plan attached to Ms. Jones' Section 42A report in a slightly modified form. The Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area is diminished in area, and given that the whole area is within the ONL, I consider that should be reinstated to its ODP limit. Farming controls have been included to support the additional character of the development and its surrounding landscape context, and I've recommended new wording which clarifies the intention of an application of these rules. RCL 0632 requests that an open space community and recreation activity area be added to the construction plan. I understand from Ms. Kesey's evidence that they've amended this request to allow for educational facilities. The maximum building height that they're proposing is reduced to 7 metres, coverage to 5,000 square metres in total, and it's requirement that building systems create the character of Jack's Point included, and I consider these to be positive amendments. Bevo Capital 789 wishes to extend development to the northern Panley Downs, including residential development in the further village centre. In my opinion, such development must remain outside of the ONL, and a spatial plan would be necessary before this was included in the proposed district plan. The Jardine Family Trust and Remarkable Station 1915 has requested the removal of references to over-domestication caused by farming in policy 41.2.1.10. I am opposed to this amendment as the wild character of the higher reaches of the zone which are currently farmed are an important aspect of the landscape character.
Before we ask Dr. Reed questions, she raised a number of matters which she said she had agreement with Ms. Kluger and presumably also Ms. Kapara. Now I'm wondering if we could get that agreement written at the sign and produced as effectively as a witness. an agreed witness statement, because that would make it much easier for us to understand what everyone agrees on. Yes, no, I appreciate that, but I don't want to be a moving feast tomorrow with differences of opinion on what was agreed on. So that could be agreed over mind and presented to us, that would be helpful. The other point I think that comes out of the evidence, particularly the summary, it would be extremely helpful for us. And if the O&L lines as shown on map 13 are shown on the structure plan, and if any of the parties disagrees with the location of those lines, they also show where they think that outstanding natural landscape starts and finishes. Because at the moment it's impossible for us to look at one at a scale of 1 to 150,000 and one at a totally different scale and come to some idea of what we're doing. That's useful.
Thank you. This is a mixed bag of questions, I suppose. First one, and I might be looking at an older version of the structure plan, but structure plan shows Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area, and within it there are sort of white strips, one along the northern boundary and another one in the middle. Are they just areas that are, what is it, are they gullies or something?
Yes, they're deep gullies, which are currently covered by the Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area, and the request is that they be uncovered.
Okay. There's just a couple of points of clarification relating to house sites. Now, originally, going back to the original report, there was an issue about house site 46. Is that now resolved?
It was 46 was removed from the hillside and moved down adjacent to the wetlands.
So there's still going to be a number 46 but in a different place?
I think so, yes. I don't have a number for it now, but yes.
Okay, well, if Jack's point or someone tomorrow can clarify that, thank you, that'll be useful. And I take it with respect to proposed house sites 51, 52 and 53, agreement hasn't been reached on that, I assume you still maintain that those three house sites you've got?
In that location, but we looked at three alternative sites for them today, which I thought were okay.
Okay.
So I think there'll be a new plan tomorrow with still the same, 56 house sites, but in a slightly different configuration.
Okay. Now, ultimately, this is something that's more, I guess, for the officers generally, and Sharon commented on that this morning. We've got a plan which shows a lot of existing house sites on the table, and it's a very, very small scale, and obviously it's going to be another 20 added, it'll be roughly another 20. I would sort of urge the council perhaps to consider the option of having enlargement plans like they do with some of the other centres. Like this area is the biggest, Greenstown, it's huge. It might be useful to sort of show those on a bigger scale. I'm sure it will mean a lot more when we go out on site to sort of have some understanding of it, but in particular at the moment the sort of the boundary between what is the old FB1 and the RHDF and the RHDG is quite difficult to understand at the moment at that scale.
Reinforce that by pointing out that the structure plan is not purely for the use of Jack's Point or purely for the use of the hearing panel, it's actually for the public. And at the moment, I doubt that the public can understand what the structure plan tells you.
Yep. Well, and just further to that too, I think if when the structure plan's been finalised, it would be very good as an obvious physical, important physical feature such as Jack's Point Hill. I wasn't, until I got about a day into the evidence, I wasn't sure where that was, and I now know where it is, but to show that, name Homestead Bay, put that on there, just, and Lake Tiwa, I think it is, it'd be useful to have those features identified because then it becomes much more meaningful to the public who might be using the plan. Now, the next question I'm going to ask relates to the state highway frontage. And firstly, just to clarify something for me, I gather if one is approaching Jack's Point from the north of Frankton, as you're coming towards it on the right hand side there's really no physical barriers, it's a big open flat area off to the right. And as you get further south, there's a bit more topographical variation next to the road, it's sort of more hummocky landscape. Is that what it's like?
Yes, I'm looking currently at the structure plan. Okay. Well, if you're following the state highway hard at the left hand side, you're following a virtually flat road with an expansive pasture dropping way slightly to the right. But once you get past Waterhead Road, which is that first indicated head trunk, the road tends a little to the east, and it rises. There's quite 60 to 80 metres difference in elevation between Bullshed Road and where the road straightens out to the south again. So yes, then the land becomes quite hummocky adjacent to the road until you get back into the long straight to the south where it levels out to the higher elevation.
Now, along that sort of more northern section there, I think I remember reading that one of the concerns you had about the original Coneburn study is that from the highway perspective it was based on like 10-second intervals, which meant that, well, 10 seconds is quite a long time in traveling in a car. Ms. Pfluger and her evidence has said, well, the main form of mitigation on there would be planting, screening, that kind of thing. And I think in your evidence you suggested perhaps a 75 metre setback within which buildings would be discretionary. So that's still your view?
That would be certainly an appropriate way of managing development, I think, along that. It's a relatively short stretch of proposed development. It's really only HDSH 1 and 2. So yes, I think it would be an appropriate way of approaching that.
Right. I was kind of back to an issue the chairman raised a few minutes ago. The area shown as OSL on the structure plan, right up the very northern end of the site, north of Bullshed Road.
Right, so
the big area there.
Area, yes.
Some of that, I presume, is ONL, and some of it is not.
Well, very little is ONL. In fact, all of the, in theory at least, all the OSL is not ONL in theory, but, the original boundary was drawn with a big pen on a combo map rather than, so yeah, I guess those issues are considered on the irresolvable, I think.
Okay.
Just on that point, does that apply also in Jackson?
Jack's Point Hill, in what regard?
Well, that's done in OSL. But there's also a large area of ONL shown on the map on this. So.
Yes, the ONL, the ONL and the OSL, they overlap. They may go there actually.
It looks like they do.
Yes, I think they do on Jack's Point Hill. I don't have an ONL line on the one I'm looking at.
No, neither do we.
It's all very, yeah. I can find one. So once a year the plan out of our plan of food scale.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the problem we face to do.
Absolutely.
As if we're going to do something completely different. I'm not sure whether it's RCL or Jack's Point, but there's a little triangle of land, 0.8 of a hectare, which has been raised in discussion. And I understand it's between RJB3 and the RHDV. Now, you commented on that and indicated that you didn't support either fully or in part that land being, I presume what they're trying to do is get it out of OSA and into RHDV so it can be developed.
Yes, Mr. Leslie talked about it on Monday the month.
That's right, yes he did. Right, so it would be RCL in that case.
Right, it's 4,740 metres. I don't think that I have any problem with what Mr. Leslie was suggesting should happen to that land.
Yes, the reason I asked that was you've got a bit of an odd OSA there because it has a straight line boundary sort of around the RJB3. It's where it butts up between the Jack's Point, or called Old Jack's Point, and the Hanley Downs. It's just one of those sort of an odd thing in the sense that it's not like a natural boundary, it's more like a straight line boundary.
Yes. No,
my next question relates to the infamous OSCR, which is the land down the other end of Jack's Point. Part of it, looking at the plans that have been provided by RCL, I'm not sure where they're looking at what is now a school. I presume it's between the OSA and the road, Jack's Point Rise, I think it's called. Now, you commented briefly on that in your evidence. Am I to take it from your evidence that you are not averse to that in landscape terms?
No, that's right. I'm not averse to the proposal. And I think it's distinctly improved by the changes that they made, that they proposed. The lower height limit, smaller footprint, and requirements that the character of buildings be intended.
Yeah. So, are you comfortable with allowing for the fact that if it's a school, you can have a classroom block, it might be 5,000 square metres. I know there's a submission from a Mr. Bravitz who says, well, we would never have anticipated having a thing like that in the area, but I'm not sure of what it allows as a right within the OSL. But
I don't think it allows for anything of as a right other than building as an adjunct to recreation, but I think the government would have to clarify that. But I think that currently it would not be expected to be any buildings in that area.
Now also, just moving back again to the RHDF area. Now when I read the evidence on that, it suggested there were two levels. There was an upper level, which I think is what you're suggesting would have the 14 house sites, and a lower level, which is suggested just be effectively amalgamated with the RHDD. Is that your understanding of what is being proposed there?
Yes, that is my understanding of what was being proposed, yes. The lower area is FA, I think I call it. It's really the gently sloping open pasture. Above that boundary, FB, it encompasses a couple of parallel gullies with rock outcrops and a lot of regeneration, indigenous vegetation. It's much more complex topographically.
Now, would the house sites that go up there be shown as house sites as they are on
Well, that would be my preference, but what's been talked about has been building platforms more in terms of what's currently required in the rural general zone. So that at the time of subdivision, building platforms would have to be identified, and that would be a control activity.
Right.
So council would have control over their location so as to protect the rock outcrops and the vegetation as much as possible.
And is it my understanding that with the house sites generally, whether it's those particular ones or the ones in the old FP1, that they should be controlled activity and not permitted as sought by the...
Yes, they should at least controlled.
Yeah, because I think they're sought permitted.
Yes, they do.
Have you read the evidence on just the wells at all?
Yes, I did. Well, parts of it, probably not all of it.
One aspect I couldn't quite follow, but in his paragraph 60, he referred to rule 41.5.2.9, which I think relates to the planting of native vegetation, and he sought a liberalisation on that, and the phrase he used was achieving an 80% canopy on the grounds of that was onerous. Did you comment on that?
Sorry, what paragraph was
it? It was paragraph 60 of Mr. Wells' evidence.
Well, I don't think that he understands quite what revegetation planting is about.
I was wondering myself, because I'm trying to think of what an 80% canopy would mean in that context, but
yes.
No doubt he'll cover that.
Yes, I mean, I guess that it's not necessarily. Generally, if I was writing a condition, for example, to do with revegetation, what I would say is actually that there should be an 80% success rate, because you do have to allow for some death in revegetation planting, unlike amenity planting where you can require the and I think that that's probably what is meant by achieving an 80% canopy. I can't recall what I said about, I just recommend a better wording for that provision here, but yes, here we go. So what I recommended was that any native revegetation required to be undertaken within the zone shall include species appropriate to the ecosystems of the area being planted, aim to reach 80% canopy closure for the ecosystem type being planted within 5 years of implementation, ensure the ongoing eradication of all plant pests which might complete the planting. So basically it's saying that if you have more than a 20% death rate, you have to keep planting until you get until you achieve that.
That's just final issue that was raised by the chair this morning. I think it might be initially by me, but we've got a situation where I guess the structure plan is referring to the land which is in the ownership of the proponents of exploit. Now the ownership boundaries don't necessarily deal with, for example, what should be an urban growth boundary or what should necessarily be an O&L boundary either. So I've got the scenario that we've got within this zone, which is not rural, a situation where you've got O&L land and land is within an urban boundary, which just creates a bit of, would you agree that creating a bit of a tension there, those two concepts? I'm aware from a question that there is another one at Fairley Hill, but even so.
Well, I'm not sure that it would be appropriate for me to express my opinion of the urban growth boundary as I'm supposed to plan. So I think they've been drawn around zone boundaries without any consideration to the actual provisions of those zones, and whether or not development was actually whether or not development would appropriately be considered for the girls on them. I mean, the fact that the urban growth boundary has been drawn around the zoning of Jack's Point over an ONL, I mean, what it's in there shows that the urban growth boundary is impossible for them to be considered.
Thank you. No, that's why I don't have any other questions.
Enjoy the conversation. Especially the preposterous urban growth boundaries.
I don't think the concept was impossible.
No, I don't take the point.
Just on that issue of outstanding natural landscapes, is it your view, and it's alluded to in paragraph 3.14, but I'm not sure if it's clear, is it your view that development in areas identified as an outstanding natural landscape in a special zone such as Jack's Point would be treated in the same way as outstanding natural landscapes in the rural zone?
As a minimum, yes. Currently, development within the ONL of Jack's Point is actually a non-compliant citizen. The level of protection is actually higher than it is in the rural zone. And so I could have supported any greater degree of liberalisation than to the equivalent in the rural zone.
Now, in the rural zone, in the outstanding natural landscapes, what provision is made for farm buildings? And if you don't feel capitalised, I'm happy to leave it to Ms. Jones if you would prefer.
It depends. Because a farm building on a holding of more than 100 hectares is a controlled activity, and I think it might become a restricted discretionary activity in an outstanding natural landscape, but I think, yeah, Ms. Jones would
Well, if that was the situation, would you, on what you have just told us about treating ONLs, would you think a similar standard would be appropriate in this case?
For farm
buildings? Yes.
Yes. Yes, thank
you. In paragraph 6.5, and you're talking here about the mitigation of the effects of the space over and under, I just wasn't sure what you were saying, and I just want to clarify it. Are you saying that it's not much of a problem?
In this particular paragraph, I was referring to what I've more recently discovered to be a flood mitigation fund, which has now been cut into via an access road,
a new access
by a resource consent. So I suspect that flood mitigation properties might be rather compromised. So there was a bit of confusion in my mind when I was discussing that. I think Ms. Jones has proposed that more clarity around mitigation planting and earthworks, I think, along the road boundary there.
Okay. Now, in paragraph 8.6, we're talking about waterways and indicative open space following those. In your view, should there be a minimum width of that, or should we just rely on some sort of scratchy line on the plan?
Ideally, there would be a minimum width, it would depend. For example, the one that runs more or less east-west is that by quite a substantial creek. So it would need therefore to be wider in order to open out the creek and flooding and decent amount of space on the side. The line that runs along the bottom of the east, the ocean space there that was by 16 really, we were looking at that this morning, it's really pretty much a ditch. I guess you could argue either way with that. You could argue on the basis that because it's really just a ditch, you could have a narrower strip, or, and I would prefer this argument myself, is that it provides a buffer between the medium density development that's proposed in Area D and the less dense development further up the hill, so that that should be reasonably wide. But,
No, I see.
Yes, very
only by peering closely have I noticed that there is actually open space indicated there.
Yes, it took me a while to read.
Structural planning for this, please. Okay. Just in paragraph 11.15, you say there in the first sentence, development of that kind would be well excused but often used, but would not necessarily have this effect. And that, to me, just seems to be inconsistent with what you said in paragraph 11.13, and I'm just wondering if I must read it somehow.
Take a minute to catch up. So we're talking about the
what you're saying in paragraph 11.15, in the first sentence, you're saying it would not necessarily have an adverse effect. That just appeared to me to be inconsistent with what you said in paragraph 11.13. But I may be wrong.
Well, my understanding of what I'm saying in 11.13 is that this is what the situation is under the ODP, but something different is proposed, and I think that it was often used but not necessarily detract from them.
In paragraph 17.5 on page 45. Can you just clarify what you're saying there is there part of the Peninsula Hill Ranger protection area that is not within the OML?
No, I think it's the opposite.
The opposite, it's the OML. But there's 150 metre gap, so if those lines are marked on the map, that will highlight that for us.
Yes, it transpires that actually one of the existing home sites is actually within the OML.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
One further thing, I had a question to Scott this morning. It may have come through, but I'm not sure. But on the key for the structure plan, there is a, right at the very bottom, is a notation called open space, immediately above overlay.
Which version? I have about
20
different
structure plans
drawn by various
people. Should be the same, but look at the key on this side here.
Yes.
You'll see just above the word overlays down there the word open space, and there's some shaded lines.
Right.
Okay, because I seem to recall an evidence was read somewhere that where those shaded lines are shown on the structure plan, which follows streams, that should be incorporated into an open space zone, so it'll be shown as open space.
I think that would be the desirable outcome, yes.
Yep. And I think Governor Scott says you've got to follow that up, so I'm just forewarning you that that's a question we had as to whether that should happen or not, rather than the squishy lines.
Yes, I think they do need to be much more clearly defined.
Thank you, Dr. Reed.
I've been engaged by Queensland Lakes District Council to provide planning evidence on Chapter 41, Jacks Point Zone of this proposed district plan. Having considered all the submissions, the memorandum of council filed on behalf of Jacks Point East and pre-stitched based evidence, I recommend a significant number of amendments to the notified chapter. Key recommended amendments from the Section 42A report. In summary, in my Section 42A report, I recommend amending the single Jacks Point Zone objectives to better reflect the intended outcome for the village area and the importance of the open space and recreational amenity of the zone. Amending and adding various policies to implement the district-wide objectives and the JCC objective and to align with the changes I've recommended to the rules and structure plan. Amending the structure plan and headquarter related rules by removing the FC1 and FC2, the EIC area from the notified structure plan, extending the Peninsula Hill landscape protection area, adding the tablelands landscape protection area, adding the new lodge activity area, replacing area RHDG with 8 home sites, removing that part of RHDF that sits within the ONL, replacing the indicative open space with an open space using community or OSA activity area, and adding a third connection to the state highway. And just to comment to you that won't just to be used amending the rules to acknowledge the existence of the third connection to the state highway, amending many of the rules relating to the open space activity areas and the landscape protection areas in order to provide greater clarity and protection of the landscape values, simplifying the rules relating to NDR development and subdivision, making all buildings in the home site and the village activity area controlled rather than permitted, and adding a comprehensive development plan requirement in the village. And just to add there, in terms of the question that was raised in terms of scope, and whether there was scope to the research and to have them be controlled, the scope comes from the fact that all buildings in the operative district plan are controlled. Making all buildings in the lodge activity area a discretionary activity rather than controlled, and slightly tightening the rules around tennis courts, amending the height restriction to enable higher buildings in the Jazz Point village in order to achieve better urban design and potentially minor intensification, to restrict building height other than farm buildings to 4 metres in the open space areas, and to relax the recession plan rules that apply to the hand-me-down residential areas. Amending the coverage rules to make the units restrictive and more effective in the village activity areas, and to make them more restrictive in regard to MBR development in the hand-me-down residential areas, and adding a cap on commercial activity in the village areas, albeit they look considerably more generous than Mr. Hay recommends because they're being limited to go. Further to the circulation of the 42A report, having received extensive evidence from submitters, I've now suggested some further changes. So I recommend amending the notified structural plan as follows, replacing the notified RHDS with RHDSA area, which was proposed by Mr. Sakar, but excluding the land that sits within the O&L, and incorporating the balance of the notified RHDS area, which is referred to as RHDSB, in the evidence of Mr. Tapar, into the OSG activity area tableland, and providing for up to 14 home sites generally within this area and the adjacent notified RHDG area. The exact location of these can be addressed in the council's right side. Amending the extent of the tableland landscape protection area by removing the easternmost part of the area shown in the section 42A Jazz Point structure plan, which is the bad area that extends from the essentially generally from the wetland, the large wetland adjacent to RHDE to the OEC activity area, so all the way down to Hunter's Bay. It'll be clear on the structure plan we can see that there's a fairly large area there that should not be tableland. So it was actually just an epic area that tableland was pushed right down to the village in that location. But on the flip side, in terms of tablelands, we would extend it over the notified areas of RHDG and RHDSB and to the western margin of the main wetland. The relevance of the tablelands landscape protection areas for your information is limited to the application of certain policies, no rules relating to the tablelands, but policies in particular one relating to vegetation. That's just the tablelands only. Adding home site 37 to 56 within the OSG as proposed by Ms. Kluger, with the exception of proposed home sites 51, 52 and 53. That may change in line with the Dr. Reid's revised extending the notified education activity area adjacent to the Jackson Point village in the manner outlined by Ms. Thompson's evidence, but retaining this area as a specific education activity area with the rules that relate to that rather than absorbing it into and adding the RHDSH3 activity area in place of the notified EIC and retaining the vegetation mitigation requirement in relation to this. I recommend further amending the JCC check provision as follows, adding a new policy to avoid recreational buildings in OSL and OSG that are not ancillary to outdoor recreational activity, and to ensure such buildings are low scale in order to ensure they are sympathetic to the open space landscape context and not the nature of scale that would be better located within an urban activity area. Adding policies that recognise the different characters of the established and unestablished residential areas, albeit with clearer reference to the RJP area and reference to achieving a range of densities within each separately identified residential activity area. Adding new policies, some of those proposed as new policies 41-117 and 41-218 is attached to Mr. Ferguson's evidence. Amending rule 41-4312, which is referring to rule 41-48, regarding the control status of buildings and the requirement for a CPD in the village areas by expanding its scope to require that the CPDs are required for any commercial, community, residential office or accommodation activity, including buildings, as suggested by Mr. Ferguson. But retaining the matters of control proposed in the section 42A version of the rule, in addition to those matters, or additional matters promoted by Mr. Ferguson. Amending rule 41.47 and expanding matters of discretion, such that only visitor accommodation in the RHDE area is restricted to discretionary, while visitor accommodation in other parts of the hand-me-down residential area will be full discretionary. Adding new rule 41.513, proposed by Mr. Ferguson, which triggers a recent consent of a covenant that's not registered on title, which requires buildings within home sites to adhere to design guidelines that are outside the district plan, provided such building continues to require a control agent, this control consent under the district plan. There's only one rule that's deemed more efficient than I favour the control consent for buildings over relying on the covenant and guidelines. And amending rule 41.592 relating to the scale of commercial activity to cap commercial activity to a total maximum floor space of no more than 550 square metres across all the RHD and RHDSH areas, not only HE, as in the notified provision. I recommend further amending chapter 27 subdivision provisions as follows. Amending rule 2761 by deleting the reference to all other activity areas, recognition that this part of the rule refers to rule 4158, which only relates to residential activity areas, and so the reference to other activity areas is not applicable. Amending the second part of rule 2761 to read as follows. The intention of this amendment is to ensure that where appearing subdivision creates large, comprehensive or unit-capable development sites that will result in site sizes of less than 380 square metres, then a restricted discretionary activity consent will be triggered. This is considered critical to ensuring that the good intentions of rules 27.5.16 and 27.7.11.3, which trigger the need for a restricted discretionary activity consent, where lot sizes are less than 380 square metres, are not circumvented by undertaking a large lot subdivision in stage one, which may result in poor layout of streets and open space that is not suitable to the initial density and which is likely to be irreversible at later stages. I'm aware that there are issues with the ability of the above proposed reading of the role and the value of the issue to consider this in conjunction with other experts to ensure the desired end outcome achieved. Amending rule 2771 to ensure control over the diversity of lot sizes in order to assist in achieving recommended revised policy relating to achieving the diversity of lot sizes and typology within each of the residential areas. Due to scope limitations, this amendment may need to be limited in this application to the JPD, and that's what that rule relates to more than I'm suggesting. Amending rule 27711 to add added discretion relating to the range of residential densities proposed within the subdivision and the location of NDR development sites identified at the time of the subdivision in terms of their proximity to open space and potential public transport routes. Adding a new rule 27711-4 as proposed by Mr. Ferguson, which triggers the resource consent of the covenant is not registered on file as requiring buildings within home sites to adhere to design guidelines. In the chapter 41. Additional information to assist the panel. Attached to the summary in appendix 1 is an updated field analysis which resulted from informal caucusing with Mr. Ferguson, the intention of which was to ensure as much consistency as possible in the figures that are being presented to the panel. The attached appendix 1 supersedes appendix 6 of my section 42A report. I generally concur with Mr. Ferguson's explanations of the key differences between our methodologies and final figures as stated in his evidence. I wish to highlight to the panel that the estimated yields achievable under the operative district plan and the notified proposed district plan have changed in Appendix 1 from those that were attached to my Section 42A report. That said, the only change that I consider to be significant is that the Section 42A version overestimated the number of visitor accommodation residential units achievable in the RHD areas under the operative district plan. This and other minor errors, omissions and inconsistencies in Mr. Ferguson's analysis have been rectified in Appendix 1. More details will be provided on the changes between the two versions if necessary. I amend paragraph 15.3a of my Section 42A report as follows to reflect the new Appendix 1. So the estimated the maximum of 5,221 residential units, residential unit equivalent, including the accommodation, enabled by the notified proposed district plan, comprising 3,254 units in the residential areas, 36 residential units in the home sites, 28 residential units in the home survey areas, 34 units comprising a mix of residential and visitor accommodation in the farm serve areas, 1,757 units comprising a mix of residential and visitor accommodation in the two village areas and the NYC area, and 112 visitor accommodation units in the lodge area. Compared to the notified CDP, my current recommendations will increase the estimated potential maximum residential and visitor accommodation yield by 219 units to 5,241, largely due to a high number of visitor accommodation and residential units estimated to eventuate in the Jack Point Village, and that's as a result of increasing the allowable building coverage and cabin commercial and community uses, and slightly more yield in the Hemingdale residential areas, and that's due to the addition of the new RHD SH3 area in place of the EIC. These increases are in turn partly offset by the removal of the EIC area. I also note that there is a considerable margin of error as to what might actually eventuate in the villages to mitigate the volume of mixed use crops. Compared to the notified PDP, my current recommendation is to reduce the estimated potential maximum GFA commercial and community activity by 109,775 square metres to 88,352 square metres. This is largely due to the removal of the EIC, which is only partly offset by the increase in building coverage enabled in the village areas. Compared to the notified PDP, my current recommendations include expanding the notified education activity area, which will increase the estimated potential maximum GFA educational activity by 20,925 square metres to a total of 54,675 square metres. I note that any education activity that was to occur in the EIC was factored in the estimated GFA for free education commercial activities as outlined above. I note for completeness that Mr. Thompson and Mr. Copeland are likely to be correct that the IEP enables more commercial activity than is now proposed under the Section 42A structure plan. However, as I understand it, PC 44 absorbs the Hemingdale village into a wider medium density RHDE area, and this part of the council's decision on PC 44 is beyond shovel. So I realise this matter may be some elements we establish in scope, we do not consider it to be a particularly relevant factor in determining the appropriateness of the provisions. Administrative issues, just in terms of various submissions, the first submission by, I can't remember the full name, but BSTGT Limited was actually being incorrectly allocated to original submissions by Joanna and Simon Kavanagh, JKRLA and RCL. This further submission relates solely to O&L mapping issues on the ground terrace and has also been correctly allocated to the appropriate submission in this regard, and as such will be appropriately considered in the mapping hearing. The submission by the order of tableland has been withdrawn 20th of January, and understand from Sir Nicholas Kelly's evidence and the memorandum of council lodged on the submitter's behalf on the 8th of February that points 1-5 of the submission by Jardine Sands Trust and the Market Station Limited have been withdrawn. I've got a small number of minor corrections transcripts of the 42A if you want them. And if you want me to front foot Ethan, well, you can actually ask questions that you ask others, hopefully, if you want me to.
Yes, I have to give you those corrections.
Yes.
Just make a note of that.
The paragraph. One 3D. That should read, second line it talks about the increase in building height of the Jackson Village, and that should, on the second line should read, increasing it to 12 metres rather than 10. 1 4B, on the last line, rather than 300 square metres, that should read 380 square metres. And same with 1 4C, directly under that. Paragraph 4.30. Remind them that should be a typo in terms of my brief discussion on the administration page, so the date obviously wrong. It should be 2015.
Sorry, what was the paragraph then?
5.30. In relation to asset management plans, the current asset management plans are 2016 to 2031. Paragraph 12.4. Second to last line of that paragraph, it reads Jack's Point is a natural area, then it is a non-applying activity. That should read fully discretionary activity. This last one, 13.1, second to last line, just in relation to the OSCR activity area, and I'd ask you for open space commercial recreation, the open space community and recreation. Avoiding confusion. Anything else? Just to avoid any possible confusion later on, paragraph 13.21, about halfway through that paragraph, I talk about limits on retail, and that should really be limits on, when I'm talking about caps, I'm talking about commercial, caps on commercial activity as a whole. Paragraph
first issue is about what sort of design this is in the first place. It's not really, I think from what I said in your report, it's not really a resort zone. It should be treated.
No.
So I think you might, in terms of the final version of the plan, it would go under what's special?
Well, they're all sitting under, my understanding, I'm not sure how they're sitting under the framework of the, it is, so
there
is going
to
be a special zone,
yeah,
special
zone. So it might have different chapter number. Yeah. Okay, and no, I just want to double check that before that was the case. There's also an interesting issue about in terms of whether it should be one or two zones. I think that issue arose in submissions in the sense that, well, we use both like an old Jack's Point, the other one's currently being developed, not really old, but you know what I mean. and Hambley Downs, which is the other one. Yeah. I think there may be a sort of a bit of an implication out there that one's a bit of a, could be a cut above the other in some ways in terms of status or whatever. And you basically argue there's no basis for doing that. But
that's right. It's always been the single zone.
I suppose the unusual thing about it though is that as a zone, if you look at its ultimate development, say maybe 8,000 people or whatever, it's going to be as big as Queenstown and Fernhill probably, which isn't a zone, it's a town, which has zones within it. So I suppose in many ways the activity areas are effectively zones of one form or another.
Yeah, that's right.
Sacrilegious thought had occurred to me in terms of whether it might be better to combine, well, at the moment you've got to talk through all the rules which might apply to an open space zone, they might apply to a residential Jackson Point or a residential Hampton Downs, is it may be better to group them as a group of residential zones with all their permitted activities and standards, or the R zones if you like, and then another one for the O zones, and another one for village zones for example, where that might make the whole format a little easier to understand. But just sort of run that one past. Mm-hmm. I want to jump off a cliff here and that, but might be, I just wonder whether that might be an easier way of doing it.
Yeah, a little
bit. Anything to make it simpler? Right. Now, in the case of Homestead Bay, you made the a suggestion that is beyond scope, I think what you suggested, is that the FBA, the effects become a residential?
That's the home, the village home, the Homestead Bay Village.
Oh, the HB.
And I mean, it's not something I have a strong view on, but I don't see anything sort of evidence before me to suggest why it's
Just to provide me with a bit of context, I'm aware that there, which is even Mr. Geddes, his response, I think the point's been raised, largely has been kept to touch in terms of the mapping changes.
Mm-hmm.
Just so I understand, what area would these mapping changes affect? Is that big wedge that sticks into the between Homestead Bay and
it's a big wedge beyond this thing here.
Yeah,
exactly.
Again, without who knows, what are they seeking in there?
They're seeking residential, it's essentially residential development, expansion of some of these areas. To be honest, I think they have.
Okay, so it could be just basically like Jack's Point residential extension.
Yes.
So there would be a significant link between what's decided on that and what's decided for Jack's Point in terms of the importance of integration between these areas? Because if it were accepted that it should be residential, then that immediately raises issues of integration with the existing area, for example.
Yes, I'll
have to have a look and see. I'm certainly responding to you on that one. I'll just grab a submission will be clear straight away whether what sort of differences they're actually seeking within those areas, whether it's residential, whether it's residential.
I'm not trying to revisit the decision that
it'd be a map chasing. I'm just sort of trying to think ahead as to what the implications might be if their position prevailed. That was really all I
was about. The issue they're raising is the concept of a fall back
or road access, whether it goes through Jack's Point or whether it goes, I'm thinking Mr. Brabant's.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of your suggestion regarding the VHB, has the loan actually responded to that? They have a view?
No, they haven't. And they also haven't expressed a view on the imposition of a commercial attack on commercial activity, which of course is part and parcel of providing the new building coverage.
Could they lodge any submissions?
They lodge submissions, and put, yes, they lodge submissions and lodge evidence.
So that's Mr. Geddes' decision,
yes,
what we're dealing with.
Just this one here, 15.73, we've had the check about the last few years, about light glare and night sky issue, where you said here, QLDCs implement rules and night sky to light impact. I presume there is a rule in the plan about Lux still is there in this district?
There is, and it's probably through the various zones. But in this one, it's not streamed. Just like that one.
So where lighting can be an issue, it's touched on in Dr. Reed's report in terms of visibility. Building coverage, liberalising the removal requirement for recession claims, road setbacks and such like. One of the other issues he raises is about building height and additional costs. Just an interesting point about that, about going to four stories in the village. Mm. Now obviously you've got a bit of an embarrassment of riches there in the sense that the amount of land you've got is owned. I think it's been calculated by the, well, probably about 2 hectares, that includes parking. Mm. And you've got this massive block of land there. Does making it or provide a greater height just make filling in that space more difficult? Or is would it even really happen given the vast amount of space?
Well, the exact point is she thought the increase to 12 metres of what Montage Machine is to provide the extra 2 metres, not so much for an additional story over and above what they could do at 10 metres, but to make it a better quality building. But they were going to go to 3 metres this way they can.
Is there any issue with the rules about having residential above retail on the ground floor?
Are there any rules about that?
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's anticipated, essentially.
So they would need a consent, something if you say a cafe on the ground floor or speciality shop and flats of other type of thing, that in itself would generate the need for a consent.
You mean in terms of 3 stories?
Yeah.
So my interpretation of that word, but certainly something I would really consider a little bit in terms of the workability of the rule, trying to think the right of reply if there's a better way to do it. We can cast that over all buildings regardless of the use. 3 stories is the maximum. within 12 metres, or at the moment, with the, you know, the fact that it's tied to the use of the building being commercial, sort of requires the use of the developer at the time of the comprehensive development plan to identify and build more flexibility. It's in the commercial building. It might not be used as commercial in the next 10 years, but it's within our commercial precinct or whatever, and we anticipate it being that, and therefore, it's a 3 metre building with a high first.
Yeah, the reason I raised that question is that I understand people are famously lazy about going upstairs for retail, so...
Yeah, correct. Like, we really, I mean, my idea of the with the role was that some component of any components, if the ground floor was commercial, then that would trigger that role, but it may well be that it's just simpler and more efficient to make the building 12 metres than like more than 3 stories, which is what would have been achievable under 10 metres.
Yeah, that makes sense. Paragraph 1646, there may have just been a typo here. What? A reference to 300 square metres there, where I assume it's supposed to read 380.
Yes, apologies, that's 380 as well.
I think that's what makes sense. Just looking at your summary of evidence, 3C, last entry is saying adding a third connection to the state highway, so that third connection, I presume, is not Woolshed Road, that's 160526, the resource acceptance grant.
Yes, so if you picked up on the fact that that's shown on some of the plans, shown on that plan that
you
have now?
Yep.
So it's the middle of one of those three accesses.
Now, in terms of scope, we're looking at 3K. What are we reasonably certain about in terms of scope, in terms of a cap on an individual retail tenancy?
Oh, in terms of an individual retail?
Yeah.
Well, the operative district plan and the notified proposed district plan both imposed a 200 square metre cap on individual commercial tenancies.
Right. So people have sought going back to the ODP, so that gives us...
Well, the notified PDP just carried that forward. The only exception that is, as I understand it, is the notified PDP introduced the EIC.
Yep.
And in the EIC, retail was kept at... Well, it had to be associated with technology, etc. So it's not just, you know. So anyway, retail was capped at 200, but there was no cap on commercial,
right.
Notified PDP.
So I've only got secure ground to go to 200 square metres, not above that, on 300.
That's my interpretation of it. In the village, there's never been a cap higher than that.
One point, and probably maybe a legal question on this, Scott, and I'm not saying this is a good idea. Under 5F, adding a new rule 41.5.3 and a similar one in subdivision, proposed by Mr. Ferguson, which triggers a resource consent if a covenant is not registered on title to the foreign buildings within home sites to adhere to design guidelines. Can the status of an activity be linked to whether or not a covenant is registered on a title? It may well be, but I just wondered if that's something that perhaps turned your minds to make sure that would be virus, I assume.
It goes further than that, it's also going to be what is the content of the covenant, the duty of the council's business.
Yeah, might well be a very good idea, just want to make sure.
Certainly find it as well.
Fjord and Tablelands, take it they are satisfied with the suggestion that the boundary should be corrected? Or they just chucked in their submission?
Well, I don't know the reason behind it, but the college knows body
And my last question, one I should give, received the International Town Planning Award for picking up the most trivial error. paragraph 10. Paragraph 10 in the summary. Increased it by 219 from 5221 to 5441. Yeah. It should be 5440 now.
Not a trivia question. In paragraph 5.8, I understood from Ms. Cop that the council's position was that the ONL area that's within the outstanding natural landscape and Gax Point should be treated the same as if it was zoned rural. And I understood Dr. Reed to say the same thing. Is this matter of recreational buildings within the ONL consistent with what is provided for in the rural zone?
No, it's not. And there's quite a lot of them. I mean, here's this one thing to say. We did look at it quite extensively, how much, how similar we could make the two, the open space areas and the rural zone. In this area, perhaps in the rural, I'm a little bit out of touch with where the rural's got to on every front. I'm assuming it doesn't provide for recreation buildings. Not need to check on that. The different thing is here is that specifically provides for recreational activity, and it's always been that small buildings have been seen to be in accordance with the structure plan.
Are there parts of the OSL and OSG which are outside of the area identified in the ONL?
There are parts of the OSL and OSG, yes.
Would the appropriate policy direction be to direct the recreation buildings to be in those parts of the OSL and OSG?
And what people have asked for in terms of how far back we can go beyond what people are asked at the moment.
Well, we can deal with scope separately, I'd like your official opinion rather than your considering our scope.
We can do it right now. I think that would be wise. I'm not sure again, just for background, in terms of plan change 44, that was the recommendation was to actually work quite a bit of this into rural.
Right.
Certainly an option.
Now, in paragraph 5D, we're talking about here the concept of a comprehensive development plan.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't your view that any comprehensive development plan that is received from that area for that area would be acceptable?
Well,
and to use that in terms of like control HIV status, which is really discretionary.
In reality, you can't put conditions on it which effectively nullifies something. I'm just wondering,
I would prefer to demonstrate the discretionary, which is consistent with where the MDR provisions are as well.
And that brings me to a question which we haven't dealt with in here, but I know that it's already been raised, and I think Mr. Ferguson proposes it elsewhere, but it may actually be in the rules that propose that in some of the activity areas there's no minimum lot size, and on the council proposal on subdivision it becomes a controlled activity. Do you have any views on the appropriateness of a controlled activity when there's no minimum lot size?
Yes.
And it's not residential?
Yeah, I do, and I think in section 42A, I just referenced my concerns, so I think full stop, but particularly in regards to the open space area, but the more I've sort of looked at it as well, the more I do get somewhat concerned by the fact that this is one of the areas against the most residential growth and most subdivision occurring. These sorts of areas are now the precise areas that through the subdivision hearing we've allowed, because they've got a structure plan, they're not strictly discretionary in terms of layout and lot design and the rest of it. And that's where the majority of our development is actually going to occur. And the structure plans are pretty broad. They provide a handful of roads and so on. So they provided the skeleton, but there's a lot of room for damage in the finer grain stuff if the block layout's not done well, and the diversity of block sizes there is going to be. And particularly that's where we might discuss about the median density, and saying that we need to, even if it's large lot subdivision, with every intention of being selling those development blocks off the people to much denser development. We're only going to have one chance really to get that layout right, and get the block size wide enough to be rearranged in the middle and things like that. So it would be good to at least have RD for those areas where the density is looking like it's going to be heading in high.
You've headed to where I want to ask you some questions anyway, so we'll deal with that now. Structure plan is an undefined term. In your view, is a structure plan purely a diagram, or does it encompass more than that?
That's right, and particularly when we get into subdivision that's in accordance with the structure plan, to me the structure plan needs to then be informed by the rules. By at least the rule 41-49, I think, in this chapter, which outlines what you can actually do in each of them, in each activity area.
Wouldn't that be assisted if the diagram, and the key in the diagram, identified what the rules were that applied, so that those rules essentially became part of the structure plan? Because at the moment there is no clear relationship, except some of the rules refer to this diagram.
It probably would. I mean, you still have the rules saying anything. Structure plan is discretionary, but all the detail sit on this.
I mean, this is a more general question because this is not the only structure plan in the district which potentially raises this issue.
That's right. And
even the three that we have in this group of hearings are not the only ones.
Yeah, that's right.
Commissioner Nixon raised the point, which I think is valid, that Jack's Point is not a zone. Jack's Point is a group of zones comprehensively put together to create a certain outcome. Would it, and I think he may have got part of the way to the answer to this issue, is would it be more sensible if the within the chapter it made clear that the activity areas had specific provisions related to each activity area?
Yeah, I think that'd be worth something.
Because some of the policies only relate to certain activity areas, and some of the rules only relate to certain. It's not just the rules, but the whole structure.
Yes, yeah, I'm glad that's right. And you're working these things, I feel like working on a whole sort of thing, but the industrial zone.
Well,
because the next thing, whether it's an actual structure, like a mini, like you should use some policies that relate to the individual and each of the rules and each of so I think that might be the only way to do it, is to just try it.
I can see that Mr. Ferguson was thinking he'd got a really late night ahead of him.
I think he'd know pretty quickly whether it looks like it's going to work.
Well, I mean, I think, and it's fair to say this, that Jack's Point has reached the stage where it has to apply to more than just Jack's Point, was it? And the while up to a certain point it was a development and visit for a particular thing, there are now a whole lot of individuals who live there, and there's going to be, according to your figures, probably 18,000 more. And for them it'll be a set of zoning rules that applies to them. And I don't think that at the moment the general public would understand this zone at all. Commissioner Nixon and I have had enough difficulty trying to come to grips with it.
Yes.
We had a certain level of experience in campaign.
No, I agree completely.
I think it's something that's really having a go at, you know, I think it'll be much easier to see whether it's going to work or not. The other broad question I've got is in terms of this issue of comprehensive development plans. I wasn't quite sure from your evidence whether you contemplated that every application in the business village area would have to be accompanied by one, or whether you were following the suggestion of Mr. Ferguson that there has to be one, and if the second application complies with it, it's okay.
Yeah, that's how I imagine it working as well, and the way that the outline
development plans
do
at the moment. But the outline development plans, we know, are for providers.
Yes, yeah. So this is being tied to the actual activity, so you're applying for a commercial building. Or you're applying to have an existing building for the purpose of setting up a, you know, whatever, call centre or something, and at that point you will, as part of your application, you'll submit the comprehensive development plan, you're relying on grant consistently or a variation to it, like if you had to, because you hopefully just say, or you just refer to the number, you know, consent that where the CPD was initially approved.
The same one that we're working under, and we are important to it. If we're dealing with an area of 26 hectares, is that a sufficiently large area that something more certain could be created, and that a reasonable consent may be actually not have sufficient certainty.
I
understand the whole purpose. The difficulty we have is not with the planning practice or the objectives that are here. The difficulty we have is the reasonable management act, which says you can only grant consent for activities.
No, I agree. I mean, we outline the development plan process when we finish in this example. We're not at a position where we can provide a more detailed structure plan, which is a shame, because in the perfect world, you might have some lot layouts, and at least get quite a long way here, and have an administrative plan. We're not at that point, so we can't do that, and therefore that's where the whole plan works so well.
Well,
this way.
Yeah, I know that's an attempt to try and fix it, and we'll look at it some more, but I'm just wondering whether it's actually a sufficiently large area, and the amount of certainty required that maybe a private plan change would be a better approach, given it's actually more onerous than the sort of consent that would really be required anyway, notwithstanding that Mr. Ferguson thinks it's a controlled activity. I'm not sure that you can have something without the ability to define it.
That's so important. Yeah, I mean, I do, the layout is, you know, hugely important in that area. Now, I mean, I think it's sufficiently large in terms of the size that works for an ODP or a DDP. It's got it, but, you know, probably in that role, we need something. The CPD really needs to, probably the development plan really needs to cover all of that area to be most useful. There's nothing at the moment in the role to find the evidence to add.
Yes.
Because all you want to do is show the first block of development. You're not finishing the whole picture. You just need to check it. That that's clarified in the role. Which we've done in other areas, required in those areas, the development plan to cover a certain area, at least a certain area.
Okay. Specific questions on the Section 42A report. We'll take the afternoon adjournment now, and then we'll come back to that. So I will adjourn until 3:15.